Well, zero sleep for 3 nights, so just in some other zone right now. So this is the unhinged and uninhibited and unedited version of the Wednesday Night Chuk, where anything that goes and anything that is said is fair game. Nothing too raunchy, don't worry. Okay, so Rashi, in the beginning of Sefer Bereishis, asks the question, which spotlights Bereishis, but also spotlights Bo. Rashi says, why does the Torah begin with Bereishis? Should it begin with HaChodesh Zelechem? So obviously the big question is, what sense to make a Bereishis? Why is Bereishis included? And that's really, most of our attention is riveted on redistilling Bereishis through the prism of Rashi's question. We all thought, what do you mean? It's obvious. Bereishis is Genesis, creation of the world. And we take a step back and say, well, maybe it isn't so obvious because the Torah doesn't really tell us how the world's created. So it's stories of the Avos. And as Rashi says, stories about the land of Israel, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world and he can deliver the land to whom he chooses. But what it also implies is that, well, if we're looking for the beginning of the halachic portion of the Torah, it's Parshas HaChodesh, HaChodesh Zelechem. This is where the law begins. This is the first law. The first law, the first halacha given to Am Yisrael on the eve of their redemption, HaChodesh Zelechem Rosh Chodeshim. And it's iconic because the way we navigate time in our lives, we've talked a lot this year, and we're working a lot this year on time and experience and duration, managing time, not wasting time, taking advantage of time, realizing the import of time, living through time, marking time, seeing sections. I hope that part of maturity is your time management. You never thought of it that way. When you thought of experience before you came to yeshiva, there was experience. Now, life is a quotient of experience measured by time. And how do you chop your time off? And how do you start important events? And how do you end important periods of time? And what are the important parts of life? And all of a sudden, time is becoming not just the background, as it was, let's say, for the Greeks, who had a very little sense of time. They dealt with universal Platonic truths. And universal Platonic truths don't really occur in real time. There's no difference between 1 minute and the next minute, or quite frankly, your life and the next person's life. Because Plato's description of life as, you know, Plato's description of the universal truth is like you're sitting in a cave, and you're looking at the fire, and you're watching the shadows being projected on the wall from the fire. So you're not, and our life is really just projecting universal truths. So of course it makes sense. And on a more literal level, when you're talking to slaves, and slaves have little time management, little time horizons, little vision. I told you, one of my lasting memories of speaking to a Holocaust survivor is when I said, what were you thinking during the Holocaust? And he looked at me very, very calmly. He didn't look at me with any scorn. He said, what were we thinking? The whole premise of the question is off. We weren't thinking. We just were in survival mode, putting one foot ahead of the other, ahead of the other, just trying to make it to the end of the day. And that's a very sad, it's a pathetic way to lead your life, where there's no tomorrow, there's no long-term vision, there's no planning. But of course, you can be dehumanized and tortured to the point where time completely disappears, completely shrivels, and you literally live in the moment, and you're just trying to catch your breath to the next moment. So it makes sense that this is the first mitzvah. But it's also the first of a long list of mitzvahs and a long list of Torah that will be delivered. So obviously the method by which it's delivered is going to be iconic. So let's see how this part of the Torah was delivered. Okay, the extra sheets around. When the Torah describes the first mitzvah, source number one, okay, HaChodesh Zeh Lechem Rosh Chodashim, Rishon Hu L'chol Chodshei Hashanah, Daberu El Kol Adas Yisrael Lemar, the word that's strange is the word daburu. We know how Torah is delivered. We're going to see this again and again throughout the rest of the 4.5 books of the Torah, the 3.5 books of the Torah, for almost four. By Daber Hashem el Moshe Lemar, Dabel B'nei Yisrael. That phrase is a recurring, it's almost rhythmic. Dabel B'nei Yisrael, Daber Hashem el Moshe Lemar, Dabel B'nei Yisrael. Yet here, daburu called Das Yisrael. Sounds like there were multiple people delivering the Masorah. And since this is the first mitzvah, then this is reflective of the entire Masorah. So whatever happens here in the introduction, this is the lead story, the lead line in the story, is characteristic of what happened throughout the rest of the delivery of Halacha. So the question is, why are there two people delivering the Masorah? What images, what values, what ideas is this Daburu meant to convey? And this is not my question. This is a question of the Mechilta. So let's listen to the Mechilta. Who was speaking? How many people were speaking? And why is the Torah drawing attention to them? And this is not just a mitzvah stuck in the middle of Parshas Masorah. This is the first mitzvah, Parshas Bo, the natural launching pad for the halachic sections of the Torah. Rashi has the Hava Mina, this should be the start of the Torah. Why is the start of our Masorah, the way that the Masorah's book ended, why is that presented as if multiple people are speaking? So, to no surprise, I guess I was listening to Dr. Wolf's conversation before. There are different opinions in the Midrash as to why many people stood up and delivered the Torah. So let's read each opinion. And of course, I won't elaborate on the second one. So the first opinion is, Rabbi Shmuel Omer v'chishne medabrim. Three people were speaking of Alok Farnemar v'yata tedaber al kol Yisrael, b'nei Yisrael. We know that one person speaking is Moshe. What's the big drama here? We know that throughout the Torah, Moshe is the deliverer. So who's the second speaker? What's the daberu? Matam lomer daberu. Ela kishahaya Moshe medaber. Haya Aaron markin azno lishmo be'ema. Umala alav hakasuv ki'ilo shemem epiagvur. You're right. If you're watching the events unfold in real time, Moshe delivers the Torah. Aaron's listening with the audience, and Moshe is the lone deliverer, the sole deliverer. Then Aaron hears Moshe's Torah, and then he gets up on stage and delivers the Torah. So at 12 o'clock, Moshe's delivering. And at 12:15, Aaron's delivering the Torah, and it's a secondary delivery. It's not through HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it's secondhand from what he received from Moshe Rabbeinu. But that's if you looked at it on your watch. If you gauged Aaron's experience, he listened with such intensity and with such sacrifice and with such passion that in his mind, it was as if he had received it directly from Hashem and delivered it directly to Am Yisrael. So in truth, there's only one person standing on stage. But in one person's mind, there are two people delivering it from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Whose mind? Aaron. If you ask Aaron, whose Torah are you delivering? HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah. And I'm a primary deliverer. How many people delivering a Kodesh Baruch Hu's Torah? Two, my brother and I. In truth, it wasn't. In truth, Hashem spoke to Moshe. And Moshe spoke to the audience, amongst them Aaron. But Aaron's investment emotionally and the degree to which he listened and strained to understand made him see it and view it as if he received it directly from Hashem. And then he was a direct parlayer or a direct deliverer of the Torah. So here it is, it's January, and we're studying a lot of Chakiros, and we're studying a lot of Brisker Torah, we're studying a lot of Tanakh, and we're studying a lot of information, and that's what this yeshiva does well. And what the yeshiva doesn't always do so well, or it's not automatic, and it's really on you to work hard at it, is this just raw, intellectually stimulating, sophisticated, which it all is, information? Or is it information that's trickling down into my subsystem, into my identity, and creating a spiritual change, and creating a religious identity, and creating heightened religious consciousness? Because when Aaron was studying Torah, it wasn't Moshe's Torah. As impressive as Moshe was, he was listening to Moshe's lips move. But for Aaron, this was HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah. He was standing in Har Sinai. All those deliveries that Hashem gave to Moshe, not just at Har Sinai, but throughout the 40 years. And as far as he was concerned, I remember listening to one of Rabbi Soloveitchik's, I heard Dr. Wolf was discussing Rabbi Soloveitchik. One of Rabbi Soloveitchik's Talmidim was a Rebbe of mine. I'm not going to mention his name, but he's a very, very, very well-known Rebbe in YU. And I remember when he gave a hesped for the Rav, and he said, let me tell you what it was like being in the Rav Shir. He was crying when he said it. He said, sometimes the level of Torah he taught us was so compelling that we literally thought as if we were standing at Har Sinai. We weren't hearing Torah from Rabbi Soloveitchik on 185th Street. I never was in the Rav Shir in his prime, but I can just so picture it. Because sometimes I'm angry at the Rav. Why am I angry at the Rav? Because when I learn a sugya sometimes and I see what other Achronim write, it's a fair fight. I mean, they obviously know a million times more than me, but my mind is nimble enough to say, well, okay, I understand what you're saying. If I go left instead of right, I'll get to a different conclusion. If I don't take this assumption, you're making an assumption about Kiven Shegid, you're reading Tosfos this way, you're reading it that way. Sometimes the rabbi call him the assassin. He just kills the sugya. Like, he's so right. I don't even have the ability to argue. I can't even imagine arguing the way he presents. Like, is there another way to learn the sugya? Is there another, obviously, very complex abstract? And when he writes about shtaras, I find myself bewildered. Like, how else can I learn it? How else can I interpret this Gemara? I don't have a way out. And then I realize I'm listening to MS from Har Sinai. I'm listening to a level of truth. There are many different levels of truth. But some of them are so adulterated, corrupted, limited, whatever, that they're not as compelling. But I imagine if HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to me, that would be compelling enough that I have no way to argue. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says something, there's no way for me to argue. And that was the experience that Rabbi Soloveitchik conveyed in the Shir. Now, you'd have to be someone like Rabbi Soloveitchik, and I have to tell you, Maybe I was too young. Maybe I was too disinterested. I didn't pick that up in Rav Lichtenstein. If I were to describe the experience of being a Rav Aaron Shear, I wouldn't have used those words. It was a different style of Shear. He didn't give us one. The Rav came in with his idea, and then it sounds like he said until he convinced you he was right. But Rav Lichtenstein taught us how to think. So teaching how to think means he displayed different approaches. He asked us questions. It wasn't if I felt as if this is the MS coming to me at Har Sinai. It was more like boot camp, and Rav Aaron was teaching us how to, and that's why his methodology has been so reproducible, because he wasn't giving us one emes. He was giving us the tools to discover our own emes and our own view through the sugya. But how can you take this Torah that you're learning, and it's something you always have to, I mean, I'm still reminding myself, like, why am I learning this sugya? Why am I working so hard? Because I want to give a good cheer, because I want to tell myself that I got, or because I see this as Devar Hashem Elokim Chayim. This is the most relevant thing in this world. Everything else in this world will pass one day. This is the Ratzon Hashem. And the closer I can get to the MS, and the harder I can work to get to that MS, the more I'll know HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the more that it will be worth my while, even if I don't yet understand it. And that's where, if you look at the Medrash, that's where the interplay between desire and effort stands. He saw it as Devar Hashem. Since he saw it as Devar Hashem, he strained. Listen to the language of the Medrash. Markinus Aznav. Markinus Aznav doesn't mean he turned his ear. Markinus Aznav means he listened with intensity. He worked hard. He tried to see into the life of the Torah. And because he worked so hard at Talmud Torah, then he was able to see it as Devar Hashem. And by seeing it as Devar Hashem, so the view affected the investment. And the investment affected the view. And the product of the investment emotionally in the work ethic and the observation, the perspective upon it, Devar Hashem, was success in Torah. Said otherwise, I can't stress this enough to you. I've been around the yeshiva world for close to 40 years. The people that become Talmidei Chachamim are not the people that are the brightest. By no stretch of the imagination. It's the people that work the hardest. And the people that work the hardest are the people that see it as Devar Hashem and are willing to invest in it. And at 12 o'clock, if you're still not through a Tosos, you don't just close the Tosos and move on, but you say, this is important. And this is something that I want to work on. It's worthwhile working. And then the work creates the attitude. And the attitude enables the work. And the work is all just interactive. When you see it as Devar Hashem, you're willing to struggle. Once you struggle, why am I struggling? Because it's Devar Hashem. And you have to always remind yourself. In time, you have to just wake up and say, there's something behind this. It's not just information. I understand it's built into the challenge of yeshiva. If, let's say, we were to invert this yeshiva and speak about all day how Torah is the Devar Hashem and not necessarily teach you Torah, so it'd be obvious this is Devar Hashem. But you won't have the skills to acquire Devar Hashem. You just have an attitude that it is Devar Hashem, and your learning would be at a very low level. We're trying to equip them with the skills of learning, and we believe the skills will lead to passion. Very often, guys ask me on interviews, what is your yeshiva's primary interest, skills or passion? And I say that's a fraudulent question. It's a flawed question. If you don't have the skills, you won't get passion. If you don't have passion, you won't develop skills. It's a hybrid. You have to work at skills so that you can have passion. And without passion, you won't invest enough to work at skills. So we're trying to give you both. But it's clear that if you catch yourself at 10:30 in the morning, you're working on skills, not on passion. And you have to translate the why and the effort and the attitude and the orientation. The reason I'm doing this is not that I want to be the best guy in the room. It's no longer high school. No one's grading me. I'm not competing with anyone. I truly and sincerely want to find the Kadosh Baruch Hu. And I believe that learning his will is the closest route and the closest conduit towards understanding HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And you know what? Listening to me, you may not be there yet, which is honest. Real change is honesty. Okay, how can I get there? I don't feel it yet, but how can I get there? Is it something you want to get to? How can you speak about it amongst people your age? Amongst people, how do I get there? Go over to a guy, Shana Bet, who you think has it. How do you get there? Go over to an older boy, Shana Dala guy. How do you get there? Tell me how you got there. How did you get to the stage we're able to see? But don't get caught. It's very easy for bright kids to get caught up here. You're great at analytics. Your processes work well. It took you a couple months just to adjust to a new set of variables and to a new syntax and to a new world. But if you're just processing up here and it's not trickling down, you're wasting your time. I mean, you can't ever say about someone learning Torah you're wasting your time, but you're certainly not growing. You're not growing the way we'd like you to grow, the way you can be growing in this yeshiva. And even if it means sometimes taking off a little bit of time from learning to maximize the growth, to think, to talk, to find, well, that's the old Musar conundrum. Sure, you study Musar at the course of Talmud Torah, and the answer in the modern world is yes. In a world in which it was obvious that Torah is the conduit and the access point to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you didn't need Musar. But today it's not so obvious. So whether it's learning Musar or whether it's working at spiritualizing the Torah, Aaron's is your message. So how many people were delivering the Torah from Hashem? The answer is one. But how many people saw themselves as living the Torah from a Kodesh Baruch Hu? The answer is 2. And think about that for your future. A lot of growth and spiritualization is having a vision for the future. How do you expect 2023 to affect your future? Ask yourself that question. What are you here for? What are you trying to build for your future? Well, part of that answer is, I just got an email from a very, very prestigious shul. I'm not going to say where because I don't want to give up any names till later. I'm not going to give names later. And the person was very, very proud. He sent me an email. They've had a search committee for fill the position of the rabbi, and they've been through 50 candidates, whatever, and they're down to the last 3 candidates, and 2 out of 3 candidates are Gush alumni. So he sent me this email, just said I should get some machas. I know they are, I know the shul, whatever. I'm not going to pick one alumni over the other. let them battle it out, the battle of the Gushies, whatever. So, I don't know, are there people in this room who in 20 years will be Rabbanim? I hope so, because I think this is a uniquely qualified place to create real leadership and real Rabbanim, understand the complexity of life and the subtlety of life. Okay, but if there are 25 people in the room right now, hope, but I don't expect to be 25 rabbis, but you can be someone who's very, very serious about Torah, very serious about halacha, the go-to guy in shul when the rabbis are away to give a shir between mincha ma'ariv, the daf yomi giver, or just the person who's very serious about inserting Torah into your home. You're not going to insert Torah. Part of the danger with experiential yeshiva programs is, A, experiences come and go, but more importantly, it's very hard to endow experience. So let's say you're sincerely from, based on the experiences you have, it doesn't translate necessarily to your children. Whereas knowledge and facts and texts, those are more easily transferable. So if you want to create a religious environment in your home, the best way to do it is to sit with your child and learn Torah. How many of you will sit with your child before the bar mitzvah and take off time? And I'm at an impasse, not impasse, but at a crossroads of life. My kids are leaving the house. I took serious, serious time with most of my kids. There's one kid I made an exception for sorts of reasons. We went through a Seder of Shas before the bar mitzvah. And that was a 2-3 year process. We sat every night and we learned Nezikin together. I don't mean Mishnah Shas. We went through 500 blot. And I really wasn't concerned with how much they would remember, how much you can remember at the age of 13. It was more the bonding time, father-son. It was more just going through 500 pages of Chazal syntax. I did most of the reading, but that's something that you have the skills now to convey. So part of it is being able to see where this is all landing, how this is all going to translate into your future. Anyway, let me segue into the next pshat in the Medrash. We're probably not going to get to the third pshat in the Medrash, but the next pshat in the Medrash, I'll tell you the story that troubled me. Obviously, I have no clue who the boy is. So if you're in the room right now, I have no idea who you are. So don't worry. If you're not in the room, even less so. So I'm not looking in any way to make anyone feel uncomfortable. It's a story I heard that's worth mentioning. I'll even close my eyes when I tell the story, just in case anyone in this room went to this. I don't want anyone to feel in any way embarrassed, but it's a really important story. Let's see the next part of the marriage, and I'll tell you the story. The next part of the marriage is as follows. Rachab Rabbi Yosha, line number 4. The Chishneh and Abram, what, this was a duet, this was a choir, Moshe and Aaron were speaking, it's crazy. Again, there's only one person speaking, so why does it represent it as if there are multiple speakers? Ella, Kivon Shemoshe Medaber. Moshe was the speaker. Haya Aaron Mimino, Aaron was standing on the right. Eloza Mismalo, Eloza standing on the left. Vitamar Mimino Shel Aaron, Itamar is up there also. We're Nadav and Avihu, are they already dead, or they're just not there because they're good, but Elazar and Itamar are up there already, Nadav and Avihu are not, but they're standing there. It looks like 4 people are speaking, 3-4 people. You're right, there's only one person speaking, but Aaron's standing on one side, Elazar's standing on another side, Itamar's standing on the third side, on the third side, but next to the other one. And there are 4 people standing, one person talking. So what's the kasha, briskers? If there's one person talking, why are there 4 people standing? What's the point having 4 people standing on stage? The answer is one person speaking, but 4 people are conveying it. And when 4 people convey it, you appreciate that there are differences between Moshe and Aaron. Personality differences. Moshe was someone who was a purist. Moshe was like a Beis Shammai person, always pursued the truth. Aaron was much more of a pacifist, was conciliatory. Oyeshalom v'rod neshalom. We don't know that much about Elazar. We know more about Elazar, less about Itamar, but they had their own differences. So instead of listening to one person deliver the Masara, you saw 4 people. They all have one common interest. A little different. Aaron had his way, Moshe had his way. So for the sake of clarity, we don't want 4 people speaking. But for the sake of diversity and appreciating that there are different colorations seen in beings, four people were standing up on stage. Okay, so here's the story. Okay, I'm going to close my eyes when I tell the story. I hope I don't fall asleep when I close my eyes. If I do, wake me up. Otherwise, here's the story. I hope it's no one in this room, but I'll wait a second. If it is, you can recover, hyperventilate, then move on. Okay. Someone told me that this week, on Monday, and I'll tell you why the story is so troubling. It's not troubling. I understand what it is to be 17 and to respond that way in a knee-jerk reaction. I want to try to educate you away from that knee-jerk reaction. Not trouble. Not walking around angry and blistering mad. Don't get angry. I just want to help you grow. So the story was as follows. Someone came over to me. He didn't say the name, and he said it very, very innocuously, so don't go looking for the reporter, the guy who told on you. And don't told on anyone. He just told me the story to ask for my guidance. And he said that he went over to one of the boys. Notice my eyes are closed. And he said, Guten Chodesh, on Monday, which was Rosh Chodesh. And the listener said something to the effect of, I can't even begin to accept that type of language from you. Why aren't you saying Chodesh Tov? Something like that. Okay, my eyes are closed. They're about to open. If you're the guy, take a second, recover. One, two, three. What bothers me about that story? What bothers me about how that person responded? Okay, let's talk a little bit about language and identity and belonging and the modern state of Israel and Hebrew and people that use different languages, because there's more to this story than meets the eye, mixed metaphor, than meets the tongue. There's a lot here to unpack. Okay, Chazal tell us that in Mitzrayim, there was a complete and total religious breakdown. Don't sugarcoat the past. They fell into paganism. Hashem barely redeemed them. At the Yam Suf, the Malachim said, Halalu of the Azara, Halalu of the Avodah Zara, why should we let the Egyptians drown and the Jews pass? They were of the Avodah Zara. Memtes Shari Tuma, without going to every medrash, they'd completely fallen apart. What did they maintain? As I'll tell us, names, language, and dress. Namely, language and dress create coding, and they create social identity, which society do you belong to? And social identity is part of personal identity. Part of being a Jew is not just finding Hashem on some windswept mountain like Maimonides and standing up there and theorizing, but being part of a community that serves HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that has its ways, and finding your own individuality within a community. Right? I don't think anyone in this room believes that had they been born a Christian, they would have all of a sudden personally discovered Judaism. We thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for giving us our role in life. We don't look down at other people's role. We feel chosen to represent Hashem in this world. But none of us is deluding. If I'd been born in North Dakota as a farmer, I probably wouldn't have discovered Yiddishkeit. So it's not as if all of a sudden I just go to a mountain, wipe away all the variables, and I'll discover HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That happened once in history, to Avraham Avinu. Ever since then, Hashem expects us to to subscribe to a mass revelation, a tradition, and a community that lives that tradition. So language and dress are important codes. And Chazal tell us, I'm just looking at my notes because otherwise I've been in a million places today. And Chazal tell us, Vahisham Lagoy Gadol, the pasuk in Parshas Kitavo, Vayed Mitzrayimab, Semat Vahisham Lagoy Gadol. What do we say every year in that Gadol? Who remembers? What's the drasha? Vahisham Lagoy Gadol Melamed. Remembers the drasha? Shehayu Yisrael Mitzrayim Sham. What we would call cultural insularity. They were different. They had different dress, different names, different language. And that cultural insularity continues into the days of Megillas Esther, where Haman is driven batty. Yesh tam achad mefuzim afarad ben amim. They're living all over the place. And yet, v'dasehem shanos, v'dasehem melechein emosim. Yet they've got their own idea. This is what drives non-Jews batty and incites anti-Semitism. Because on the one hand, everyone respects Aborigines. Documentaries on the Nature Channel about the Aborigines who live amongst themselves, or the people that live in the Amazon jungle forest by themselves, they've got their own customs. The Amish, how quaint it is. So if you want to live by your own customs, create your own insular society. What does it mean to live across the world, be involved in business, be involved in science, be involved in literature, be involved in philosophy, be involved in history, and yet still maintain your cultural identity and not take the shape of your respective containers, not be Englishmen, Frenchmen, Irishmen, Argentinians, whatever, but being Jews and having some common language. They don't know what to make of us because we understand that we were chosen to change the world, but we can only change the world by maintaining our Jewish identity. We don't change the world by becoming them. We change the world by standing for something different. And this is the great, great miracle of anthropology, that a nation without a natural viscosity, without a natural bonding, because we didn't have a country that kept us together, we didn't have a common flag, we didn't even have a common indigenous language, we created markers and coding to keep ourselves together. One of them is Torah Shebaal Peh, one of them is Shmiras HaMitzvos. One of them is, throughout every generation, or throughout different generations, Jews developed their own language. And very often these were language which were, and I'll use this in no way meaning to be pejorative, just to show you what they are, they're basically bastardizations of other languages. So for example, even when we lived in Babylonia and everyone spoke Aramaic, we created our own form of Aramaic, and that's the Gemara's Aramaic. So we took the language of our host, because we had to speak in that language, but we created inflections and intonations and accents and words that lent it a unique Jewish flavor. So there's a difference between speaking high Aramean and Jewish Aramean. And then it happened again in Spain, where the Jews took Spanish, classic Spanish, and they created a language called Ladino. And that became a Jewish language and became a source of piyutim and the people who studied Ladino. Now, between roughly the years, I'm just picking broad round figures, when Jews started migrating from Western Europe would be France and England and even Vienna, and migrating over towards Central and Eastern Europe, which is heavily influenced by German / Russian / Polish / Prussian, depending on which century you're in, whether Poland exists or doesn't exist, big question. So all of a sudden, this new language develops, and that's called Yiddish. And Yiddish takes a lot of those languages and, of course, creates Jewish words and throws in a lot of Hebrew as well, becomes a very, very colorful language. And that's how Jews survive, and that's how Jews thrive. That because the language of Torah scholarship and Torah flourishing, and that's why there's, Baruch Hashem, been a revival of Yiddish today. Now, we no longer, most of us in this room, I happen to speak Yiddish, but most of us don't pursue linguistic Yiddish. But this represents our heritage, and this represents our past, and this represents the celebration, and so much of living in Eretz Yisrael, I get this a little bit before, living in Eretz Yisrael is looking back, now that we're no longer under the gun, we're no longer facing Baruch Hashem Holocaust and pogroms and suffering, and what were the last 2,000 years? What, I'm writing a book on this, my book, like how can I look back at the last 2,000 years from the vantage point of being here? Because when you're in the middle of it, it's hard. You're struggling, and you're pogroming, and you're being killed, and you're fighting. And now we're back, and we're standing on a mountain, and we're looking back at the valley of tears. And we're saying, what was the Emek HaBacha? What did it entail? How did we survive? What do we make of it? How do we process? It's a whole new language, a whole new frontier. So to be able to look back, and the same would go about Ladino. If you came over to me and wished me, I don't know how to say good chodesh in Ladino, but if you came over to me and wished me, I think it's beautiful. Here you're pulling part of our past and you're using phrases that, let's say, Jews used in the 15th century or the 16th century on their way from Spain to Greece, on their way from Spain to Palestine, whatever it was then, on the way from Spain to Algeria, and you're capturing something. And Baruch Hashem, one of the things I'm proudest of in the yeshiva this year is that little booklet that comes out with the Sephardic Torah, that, what do they call it? Krishna the Milsa, right? It's really fantastic that we're capturing our past in a way that being back in Eretz Yisrael allows. So the fact that you are back in Eretz Yisrael should make you more appreciative of the long road to get here and all the cultural tools that were necessary and were vital in creating our insularity, which is always central. Insularity is not a bad thing. It's a cursor. And you move the insularity cursor, you calibrate it depending on how much exposure you want and how much you want to maintain cultural identity. And anyone has that cultural insularity cursor. And you move it across depending on how, you don't want to be multicultural. Look at the Netherlands. The Netherlands became a multicultural state in the 60s. It's falling apart because there's no ethos, there's no common bounds, no common narrative. It's just one big drug party because no one's there for anything common ground. There's no common past. There's just one big cosmopolitan country. There has to be, and that's the struggle of the modern man, is to create who are we, what's our identity, what do we share in common, what are our families based on, what's our national narrative, without it being exclusionary and discriminatory. And humanity is struggling to find that balance. How do we create values, identity, acceptance, tradition, without it being discriminatory and include? And the irony is, the most discriminatory policy is the one that has no narrative. That ends up being discriminatory even against minorities. Minorities fare best when there are values, but there's space carved out for them to live within those values, because it creates a stable system of respect for value. Oh, I respect my own values, I can respect your values. Once there's no sense of personal respect to values, it's hard to respect another person's values, because values start to become one big carnival. Now, the second reason that person may have said, I can't listen to have a Guten Chodesh, is like, okay, it's one thing if you would have told me Guten Chodesh in Ladino, whatever that is. Or you would have wished me Guten Chodesh in Aramaic, Yarcha Tova or something. Because no one really speaks Ladino anymore. And no one speaks Aramaic, except for yeshiva guys in a Beit Arik and Shir, the first week Aramaic challenge. But here, you know what bothers me? I'm surmising in this person's mind, because that sounds like those people who I disagree with and who don't make room for me or don't respect me. It sounds like those Hasidim from Square Town or those Hasidim from Satmar who would wish each other Guten Chodesh. Since when are they those Hasidim? They're us. There's certain differences. They tend to be inflated because they're very, very easy and fun to talk about. Hashkafa is the greatest invention of Bittul Torah ever. You spend your whole night hacking about Hashkafa and you think you're talking about important things at the cost of learning real Torah. So why not? I mean, there are many, many different ways to be about the Torah. Sperm shopping is another great way. Comparing yeshivos, that's always good. Hashem knew that people had to have Bittul Torah, so he created four or five things that sound from, and they're really silly, but young minds get attracted to them. It's called Hashkafa, it's called Yeshivos, it's called Svarm Shopping, it's all these things that are total Bittul. Lulav, Dalet Minim, it's another one. So Hashem wanted it to be Kasher Bittul Torah. How much do you share with those Hasidim and the Satmar people about real things? Torah, Tefillah, Midos, Chesed. But Rabbi, they speak negatively of us. Since when is Avodas Hashem a competitive sport? Since when do you care about what anyone says about you? Since when are you looking for parity? You have a responsibility to be as perfect and as successful in Avodas Hashem as you can be, even if you are the only person on this planet. What is their attitude to you? Even if it's true. I don't even know if it's true because I haven't interviewed them. Chas v'shalom, anyone in this room should ever be sick in New York City for an extended period of time. But if you ever are, you know who will take care of you A to Z, soup to nuts, morning to evening? Satmars, who have inhabited and have occupied basically every hospital in New York. They purchased apartments near the hospital, which they will give you the keys to live as long as you want, and they will feed you three meals a day and take care of all your needs. Because they excel in Avas Yisrael, which is their Masara. And part of the Masara of Avas Yisrael was the Satmar Rebbe telling everyone the Zionists caused the Holocaust. Because he loves you, and when he loves you, he cares about you. When he cares about you, he feels compelled to say things, which obviously are uncomfortable to say, but he cares so much about you, he had to say. It wasn't said with anger. It wasn't said with dismissiveness. It wasn't said with, I hate you. It was said with, this has to stop, because if Zionism isn't stopped, in his mind, another Holocaust in theory could occur. Chas v'shalom. So he was raising a flag. I think he's wrong. You can differ with someone without assassinating their character and while still respecting them as Gedolei Yisrael. Gedolei Yisrael make mistakes. So in my opinion, Satmar Rebbe made a mistake. Doesn't make him less of a Gadol B'Torah. Doesn't make him less of a Gedolei Yisrael. If he came into this room, I'd run over and roll in his dust. So forget the fact that you're wishing me Guten Chodesh in Ladino and you're capturing some of the beauty of 16th century Jews. You wish me Guten Chodesh like a Jew would do in Williamsburg or Crown Heights or New Square or B'nai Brak. And what's wrong with that? What's wrong with being able to draw and grow from as many, many Yidden and over the Hashem as you can? And it gets even more urgent for those of you who Chas v'Shalom will not stay in Eretz Yisrael. Those of you who will stay in Eretz Yisrael, you can in theory delude yourself, because it is a delusion, and say, well, you know, in Eretz Yisrael, there's a strong enough Dati Lumi community. I don't really need more yeshivish, more charedish. I could just hang out in Alon Shvut and hang out in Modi'in and hang out and I don't know where, in Beit El and hang out in Yerucham. Good luck with that. That's why a lot of people don't succeed so much, because they create a very narrow band of Torah personalities. But let's say you can at least delude yourself into thinking that. But let's say you want to go back and let's say live in Detroit. How many Dati Lumi Batei Medrash are there in Detroit? Not that many. How many yeshiva outlets of Torah are there? Quite a few. Well, let's maybe up the ante. Let's say you happen to live in Los Angeles. Okay? You walk into, I'm not going to say the name of Yeshua at night. There must be 400 Dati Lumi people learning in Yeshua at night, right? But if you go, let's say, to some other places, there are 400 people learning at night in more yeshivish places. So for whatever reason, the American Torah world, pretty much outside of Israel, the Torah world has a much more yeshivish inflection. I'm not saying Haredi, but the dress and the orientation and the Eshkafa. So if you decide you're just going to, you're basically severing yourself from any sources of Avodas Hashem, from people, from growth, from experiences. So you have to break this Haredi phobia. If you don't break it this year, it's gonna straddle you. It's gonna suffocate you. And I imagine that part of the reason this boy found that Guten Chodesh so offensive is not just because it was an outdated language, but because it's a language that those people use. Take out the word those. It's a language that our people use. There's a slightly different part. I just received an email. I have to respond to him. He's probably listening to the share tonight. From a guy in Lakewood, a Kolo guy in Lakewood, whatever. I got it earlier in the week. I haven't had a chance to respond to emails yet. He says, he listens to my shiurim, whatever, the whole spiel. He says, I just wanted you to know that your Torah is being appreciated by people in the other camp. So I was about to send him back and say, as far as I'm concerned, you're part of my camp. Tell me when Color Wars, maybe we'll be on the same team. I don't see Lakewood as a different camp. It's part of one camp, one Olam HaTorah, slightly different views. It really... I couldn't tell you, I'm not saying this dismissively, I'm saying this with all sincerity, it could bother me less how they view me. It's not in my field of vision. My goal is truth. My goal is Avodas Hashem. And I, as part of my Avodas Hashem, I see them as part of our group. We differ on important issues, and those are legitimate. I told you the story of Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim once went to a Kenes Gedolim, and the Dvinska Rav, the Beinu Meir Simcha, got up to speak, and Reb Chaim turned his chair, and we didn't want to look at the Meir Simcha. Because he was such a fanatic for his position. Could you imagine turning your chair away from the Meshech Chachma? And then when Reb Chaim left the Kenes HaGedolim, he told the Shamish, let's go say goodbye to the Dvinska Rav. And the Shamish said, what are you talking about? You turn your back on him. Chaim said, I turned my back because I disagreed with his position. But he's a Dvinska Rav, and we have to be mechabed him. Let's go be mechabed him. So you can disagree sharply with a position without creating a wholesale dismissal of the person or of the community. Yes, do I believe that a way to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu is by believing in the state of Israel and serving in the army and being exposed to the world around you, liberating women for a high-level Talmud? Yes, I believe that. And I saw Gedolim live the type of life that I'm trying to live. Is that the only way to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Of course not. And I respect people who take different views, and they're educated views. They may not be my views. They're not gobbledygook. They're not silly. They're well-thought-out ideas that I may differ with, so I differ. And this is my derech, and that's their derech. And I'm thrilled to say, if someone comes over to me in the street when I'm in America, Guten Shabbos, I don't say, and Shabbat Shalom to you, my friend. Happy to say Guten Shabbos. Why don't we say Shabbat Shalom? Everyone's that I don't even know. I don't even care. Stop caring. Second you care is you're wasting your brain cells on the Narishkeit. The third reason that the person may have been opposed is not just that it's an antiquated language, and not just the language that those people use, but this is also a very, very dark issue that I want you to be aware of. One of the challenges of living through Geula, after so much suffering in the past, is this secular Zionist narrative that everything that happened before 1948 was embarrassing and shameful and pathetic, and we have to recreate the Jewish identity to be strong and muscular and athletic. This is Max Nordau, a successor to Herzl. He spoke a lot about the Maccabiah and the Jewish athletics. And if you just look at it through that lens, you're right. Everything before 1948, we didn't have an army. We were punching bags of history. People abused us with impunity. And now all of a sudden we have our army and the new Jew. That's a very, very, very dangerous road to take. Did the world shift in 1948? Yes. But is everything before 1948 meaningless? Obviously not. It's not meaningless in terms of our Masara and what we accomplished in this world. It's not even meaningless in terms of redemption. I keep telling you, when did Reishit Tzmichas Geula Seinu begin? Reishit Tzmichas Geula Seinu began the moment the last Jew left Yerushalayim in 70 AD or 136, depending on when you're counting, and performed the first mitzvah. And everything since then has been an aggregate of Geula. Every mitzvah, every tefillah, every mikvah, every tehillim, every ma'aseh chesed. Two things happened in 48. Number one, look at my hand. The graph shifted altitude radically. So here's the graph of Geula, mitzvah, 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 tefillah, 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 daf gemara, daf gemara, daf gemara, chesed, 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 tefillin, tefillin, tefillin. All of a sudden the graph shoots up meteorically. Second of all, not just does the graph of Geula change, but a second graph opens up. This is called the metaphysical graph. More mitzvahs, more chesed, metaphysical. You can't see it, but it's happening. And there's a second graph, not just metaphysical Geula, but real hard, what's what we're looking for, physical Geula. Army, police, communities, roads, trees, gardens, social welfare. Now we can create Mashiach and redemption, not just in the metaphysical sphere, mitzvah, 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 chesed, 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 daf gemara, daf gemara, daf gemara, and then it shoots up. But now we've opened up a new graph. Let's build a home in Alon Shvot that will welcome Mashiach. That's a good idea. Maybe I should try sometime. Let's build institutions. That's a good idea. Let's build a police force. Great idea. Let's build hospitals. We're going to need that when Mashiach comes. So now we're creating Geula, not just in the metaphysical sphere. We're creating Geula in the what we call the terrestrial, practical, palpable sphere. Okay, but it's a long process. And you'd be surprised how dangerous that view is. It's a very, very, I struggle with my children. I was raising my children because it's indigenous to Israeli culture. Oh yeah, that's old style. And that's what they did in Europe. And now we're in Eretz Yisrael. And there's a new approach and everything. And obviously my kids didn't pick it up in such a fanatical form, but it was very subtle. And it took a long time. Right? Someone asked me, and I'll end here. What would be my first shift if I were made head of the Jewish agency? So what would be my first prerogative? I'd start a birthright program. What do you mean? There is a birthright program. Yeah, I'd send children of American Olim back to see the birthright of their parents. Because it's very hard for kids of American Olim to connect and identify with what their parents lived in America, because everything in America seems so quaint and meaningless when you make Aliyah. And I would send kids back to see the communities that their parents built, that their grandparents built, and what it means to live in New York in the 20s in the East Side, what it means to live in Poland, not a Holocaust trip. And I would have, because that's where a lot of the kids of immigrants of Olim suffer, because the past is meaningless to me, because I've turned over a new leaf, and now I'm looking forward, and I'm absorbing from the culture, and absorbing from the world around me. And so much of your identity is looking back at your parents. What did they build? Where did your grandparents? Right? In England, even more powerful, because you're living in communities that have gone through five or six generations. America, you live in a community for a generation, you move to the next community, move to the next town over. Whereas in London, you're davening, I know, you're shul, but people daven in shuls that have been through five or six generations. You've been to shuls like that. So you feel as though, oh, we've built something. Something solid here. It's an applicant. We've built something. You're in touch with your communities. So I actually send children of Olim back to America to see, what's your parents' heritage? What are you connecting to? Those are the three things that struck me about this thing. Why in the world would you be opposed to hearing Guten Kodesh? Now, you may want to say Chodesh Tov, which is also fine, because language is a personal expression. If you feel so proud and triumphant to be part of the modern return to modern Hebrew, of course say Chodesh Tov. But why would you be so affected and so offended? I can't even listen to that. It's part of our past, and it's part of our current Jewish world, people that are sincerely dedicated to the same value system that you're trying to discover. And it's part of a past that may not always seem immediately glorious until you're able to put into perspective. Those are the three things I wanted to talk about. It's only loosely connected to this medrash. The reason I connected to this medrash is there are four people standing on stage. Not everyone's the same. And your experience is enriched by seeing four people and being able to collate differences and integrate them into your message. Okay? We'll stop here. Guten Shabbos. Shabbat shalom, everyone. Guten Tacht. Good night, everyone. Laila Tov. Laila Meraneh. Guten Schluff. Sleep well. Don't get caught up in Nash thing, guys. You guys have such limited brain cells as it is. Don't worry about it. Let's face it. Hashem didn't give us much. You're going to waste it on this Mishigas. Waste it on important things. Someone actually told me that Rav Schechter, one of the boys who was back, told me, in the name of Rav Schechter's son, I found this an interesting story because it's Rav Kanievsky style, that Rav Schechter has started, this is from his